From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
I'm on a job. Get one of my guys. Howie! He's under.
He's under, meaning undercover, says a police officer on a police videotape to a uniform officer at a critical mass bike ride.
Police in New York City have been engaged in massive surveillance using undercover police officers at political demonstrations. The fact that the officers are not identifiable is really a shield for misconduct.
Today, covert police surveillance of political protest in New York City. Newly released videotape shows what the New York Times describes as the robust presence of disguised officers since the Republican National Convention in August 2004. We'll speak with the New York Police Department eyewitness video, the New York Times, and we'll take a special look at the cycling advocacy movement Critical Mass. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Memorials were held across South Asia Monday to mark last year's tsunami that killed over 200,000 people, leaving nearly 2 million homeless. It was one of the world's worst ever natural disasters. Indonesia alone lost over 170,000 people. This is the Indonesian president, Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono.
Ladies and gentlemen, let us now bow our head in silence to pray for the souls of hundreds of thousands who lost their lives as a result of the tsunami of the December the 26th last year. May they rest in peace by God's side. The moment of silence begins.
On Monday in Aceh, sirens from the region's new early warning system were sounded at 8:16 in the morning to mark the exact time the tsunami hit the coast. A minute of silence was then observed. Hundreds of white-clad Achenese held a morning memorial at the Grand Mosque, which was one of the area's only structures to remain standing after the tsunami. Memorials were also held in Thailand, Sri Lanka, and India. This is Indrani Rajadurai, director of Help Age India.
We are taking this candle to make a sort of a, give them a feeling that we are also part of their, you know, grievance, I mean, their problems, as well as their struggle for life. So today we are taking this just to make everyone to feel that we are be with them. We are there to think about them. And we pray that, you know, the departed soul should rest in peace.
International aid groups are warning much still needs to be done in the region. A new survey from Oxfam found 80% of the 1.8 million people left homeless by the disaster were still without satisfactory permanent housing. On the Indonesian island of Sumatra, all of its residents are still living in tents or shelters. Overall, Oxfam estimates some 300,000 new houses still need to be built in India, Indonesia, and Sri Lanka. The United Nations is also warning the international community cannot forget the devastated region. This is Kamal Dervis, administrator of the United Nations Development Program.
We must be in there for the long haul. Our advocacy role on behalf of the most vulnerable has to continue. We have to, of course, document what is happening, and that's why the financial tracking is so important. And we have to work, of course, with the local communities and with their governments, so that the effort goes on, the effort continues, and that the international community also sees that things can work so that the resources put in actually have a return, that tangible things are achieved. Not immediately, not in the short run. These disasters take a long time to overcome. Even very developed countries, Japan, Kobe earthquake, took apparently 7 years to fully reconstruct the city. So it takes time, and we have to be in there for the long haul.
That was Kamal Dervis of the United Nations Development Program. U.S. News and World Report has revealed the federal government has been secretly monitoring radiation levels at over 100 Muslim sites in the Washington, D.C. area, including mosques, private homes, businesses, and warehouses. Similar efforts have taken place in at least five other cities: Chicago, Detroit, Las Vegas, New York, and Seattle. The monitoring reportedly required investigators to go on to private property, although no search warrants or court orders were ever obtained. Meanwhile, new questions are being raised about the extent of the National Security Agency's surveillance program inside the United States. Both the New York Times and Boston Globe have run a series of articles suggesting the extent of unchecked domestic surveillance is far greater than previously reported. The White House has admitted the NSA has monitored the calls of individuals with suspected ties to Al-Qaeda. But the Globe is reporting that, in fact, the NSA has been using computers to monitor and data mine all international phone and internet communications by Americans. The New York Times also revealed that the U.S. telecom companies agreed to give the NSA backdoor access to all of their networks. President Bush has summoned editors from the Washington Post and New York Times to the White House at least twice in recent months to request the papers hold stories. According to the Washington Post media critic Howard Kurtz, Bush first asked the Post's executive editor Leonard Downey Jr. not to publish an article exposing the existence of secret CIA prisons in Europe. CIA Director Porter Goss and John Negroponte, the Director of National Intelligence, also reportedly attended meetings with editors from the Post to discuss the story's publication. The Post went ahead and published the story, but did not reveal the locations of the prisons at the Bush administration's request. President Bush also met with top officials at the New York Times on December 5th to ask they reveal the Bush administration had authorized eavesdropping on Americans with the United States without court orders. The Times had originally uncovered the story before the 2004 election, but held it until 2 weeks ago. The latest call for the possible impeachment of President Bush is coming from an unexpected quarter, the prominent business publication Barron's. The editors of Barron's have criticized Bush for authorizing the National Security Agency to spy on Americans without court warrants. The editors wrote, quote, "Putting the president above the Congress is an invitation to tyranny. The president has no powers except those specified in the Constitution and those enacted by law. Willful disregard of a law is potentially an impeachable offense. It is at least as impeachable as having a sexual escapade under the Oval Office desk and lying about it later." In news on Iraq, the Washington Post is reporting the number of airstrikes carried out each month by the U.S. has increased almost fivefold this year, from roughly 25 in January to 120 last month. The number of Iraqi civilians killed in the airstrikes is unknown. Medical workers recorded 97 civilians died from U.S. airstrikes around the city of Qaim in early November. Meanwhile, a month has now passed since four peace activists with the Christian Peacemaker Team were kidnapped in Iraq. Over the weekend, the families of the men took out radio and newspaper ads in the Iraqi press calling for their release. The appeal said the four men, quote, "are all working as activists for the sake of peace and to aid the Iraqi people." In other Iraq news, the U.S. is refusing to hand over control of its jails to the Iraqi government. The U.S. military commander in charge of those prisons told the New York Times that Iraqi jailers must, quote, meet the standards we define and that we are using today. In Baghdad, more than 5,000 people demonstrated today, denouncing last week's elections as fraudulent. Protesters were mostly backers of Sunni and secular parties. On Friday, some 20,000 Sunnis protested in Baghdad, Mosul, Tikrit, and Samarra, among other cities, against the election. Meanwhile, early voting tallies show that Ahmed Chalabi failed to secure a seat in the new Iraqi parliament. Prior to the war, some officials inside the Bush administration wanted to put him in charge of the country, even though he lacked any popular support. In Egypt, leading opposition politician Ayman Nour has been sentenced to 5 years in jail. Nour formed a political opposition group last year to challenge President Hosni Mubarak. Last week, Nour was rushed to a prison hospital in serious condition after taking part in a hunger strike to protest his detention. An Italian court has issued a European arrest warrant for 22 CIA agents suspected of kidnapping an Egyptian cleric from the streets of Milan in 2003. The CIA agents are accused of grabbing Hassan Mustafa Osama Nasser off the streets, then flying him to Egypt, where he was reportedly tortured. Meanwhile, the U.S. government has admitted it may have flown detainees to Syria, even though the country has one of the worst human rights records in the Middle East. The U.S. embassy in Britain was forced to make the admission after the U.S. ambassador to Britain, Robert Tuttle, told the BBC, quote, "I don't think there's any evidence that there have been any renditions carried out in the country of Syria. There is no evidence of that." But the U.S. embassy has issued a clarification to Tuttle's comments, acknowledging the reports in the media that the U.S. had, in fact, sent detainees to Syria. The embassy spokeswoman, the ambassador, quote, recognized there had been a media report of a rendition to Syria, but reiterated that the United States is not in a position to comment on specific allegations of intelligence activities that appear in the press. In New Orleans, police have shot and killed a 38-year-old man who was carrying a knife. Police said they shot him after he refused to drop the knife and threatened an officer. One witness who saw the victim with the knife shortly before the shooting said it didn't appear he was going to hurt anyone. The New Orleans Indy Media site reported the man was known in the neighborhood as a harmless but friendly mentally disabled individual. And in Massachusetts, a college student has admitted he fabricated a story about being questioned by federal agents for seeking to borrow a book written by Mao. The report first appeared in the Standard Times in New Bedford, Massachusetts, and was picked up around the world. The student initially told his professors about the visit and claimed Mao Zedong's Little Red Book was on a watch list of books.
Broken bicycles, old busted chains, rusted handlebars out in the rain. Somebody must have an orphanage for all these things that nobody wants anymore. September's reminding July. It's time to be saying goodbye. Summer is gone, but our love will remain like old broken bicycles out in the rain.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Today we spend the hour looking at covert police surveillance in New York City. Last Thursday, the New York Times published an article revealing it had obtained videotape showing the New York Police Department conducting surveillance by planting undercover officers to secretly infiltrate and monitor anti-war protests, bike rallies, and even a vigil for a dead cyclist. The footage the Times obtained showed officers holding protest signs, carrying flowers with mourners, riding their bicycles, and videotaping people at events. The Times says the footage shows at least 10 undercover operatives taking part in 7 public gatherings since the Republican National Convention in August 2004. In an editorial published the day after the story ran, the Times wrote, quote, "It's a sad day when a police force generally known for its professionalism is caught using underhanded tactics to spy on and even distort political protests and mass rallies." This is the latest in a series of revelations about domestic spying that have come to light in the past few weeks. Last week, NBC News revealed the Pentagon has been monitoring peaceful anti-war protesters. And the New York Times exposed how President Bush ordered the National Security Agency to eavesdrop on Americans without court-approved warrants. Also, newly released documents show that counterterrorism agents at the Federal Bureau of Investigation have been monitoring domestic organizations active in causes as diverse as peace, the environment, animal cruelty, and poverty relief. In a moment, we are going to speak with Jim Dwyer, who did the expose in the New York Times. We'll also speak with Eileen Clancy, who is with Eyewitness Video, who provided the videotapes to the New York Times. But first, we're going to an excerpt of a documentary about the cycling movement known as Critical Mass.
Critical mass is like a way of saying, hey, everybody, come on, let's do it. We can all do this. We can all make our city a better, more fun place to live.
If you ride with a bunch of other people, it feels good.
Bicycle riders which call themselves critical and a system which calls them criminal.
At Union Square, and we take to the streets and we ride.
This is Critical Mass, and it's just very cool to be able to exercise democracy. This is what democracy looks like.
You could see that there's a direct relation to more people biking, the critical mass is being big.
Way bigger than last time. This is mad.
Really about reoccupying the city on a different basis, and that pleasure is a crucial subversive principle of that reoccupation and re-inhabitation of our lives.
It's amazing. Like, as far as I can see, in either direction is bicycles.
When you're riding your bicycle, it's an amazing thing. You really feel the connection between like what you do and how it affects everything else. And you really almost, without even realizing it, become very environmentally aware.
Nothing here is for sale. You're not even welcome to sell anything here. It's all about just coming together with a bunch of other people, moving through the streets. You're mobile. You're in motion the whole time. And you don't know what's going to happen. It's actually open-ended. And you cannot predict what is going to happen at any given moment in critical mass. And I think that's part of the magic of it. It speaks to people's craving for authentic, spontaneous human interaction and community. It's something you don't get to do very much in the society. I've been involved in critical mass since day one. I was one of the people who helped start it with about, you know, several dozen other people here in San Francisco. The concept came along to try to meet up once a month and fill the streets with bikes. the logic of the dance between critical mass bicyclists and police, wherever you are. There's been a number of incidents. New York is definitely on the forefront of this struggle right now. The police, on some level, as individual rank-and-file policemen, are offended by critical mass.
An excerpt of the documentary Still We Ride by Elizabeth Press, Andrew Lynn, and Christopher Ryan. When we come back, an excerpt specifically on police surveillance, and then we'll be joined by representatives of the New York Times, of Eyewitness Video, and the New York Police Department. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Before we go to our extended discussion on the exposé of undercover police surveillance of political protest in New York, we wanted to play another excerpt of Still We Ride, the film that examines the police crackdown on the monthly critical mass bike ride in New York that looks at some of the covert police tactics used by the New York Police Department. It's directed by Elizabeth Press, Andrew Lynn, and Christopher Ryan. Elizabeth Press is a producer here at Democracy Now! Welcome, Elizabeth, to introduce this piece. I certainly remember well at one of the critical mass bike rides that you were on when you just had passed Times Square, coming out to see the ride, and you were filming the whole thing. When we spent most of our time trying to get you out of detention, out of arrest.
Yes. And yes, so since then, since that night in August, I've been documenting critical mass with a few other people, and there have been more than 650 arrests in the last 16 months, and we've created a documentary called Still We Ride that we just saw a clip from, and we're going to see another clip from, and this clip comes from after the October critical mass ride in 2004. In October, there were 35 arrests on that ride, and then there was an after party at the Time's Up space, and Time's Up is a direct action environmental group that exists here in New York City, and this is a clip that leads into the story of undercovers.
It's the night of October 29th, going into the 30th. We're at the Time's Up Environmental Space on 29 East Houston Street, New York City. Today we had the critical mass bike ride. We had a federal judge trying to protect us with the permit rule. We had a small party at the space.
By about 11:30 or so, there had been several undercover cops, including a lieutenant finale wearing this Redskins jersey. She'd sort of come into the party very definitely undercover, no badge showing, and apparently she had sent a distress signal. I don't know why she would have. If she were inside the party, she would have just seen people dancing and having a good time.
The police tried to come into the space without a permit. We were able to hold the doors back. They started pepper spraying the street and arresting people. Now they have us. They have the whole place surrounded.
We're not
picked up this one woman. They took her camera. They were trying to wrench it out of her hand, and she ended up having damage to her wrist from, and they completely destroyed her video camera. It was actually the Lieutenant Finale who came at her and like smacked the camera out of her hand.
What happened to your hand?
They were trying to get my camera out of it, so they were hitting it repeatedly to get me to release the camera.
What is it all about?
I don't know. It's about people trying to show that they're in control, I guess. Two different crowds, two different mentalities.
Right. All I saw was the people dancing.
People were dancing and the cops just showed up.
Man,
and
it was crazy. I have no idea. I'm trying to get my work up to go home.
Yeah.
They called Norman Siegel and woke him up, and he came down and...
Okay, this is Norman Siegel. He's our lawyer.
Listen, let's do this in a really orderly fashion.
We were able to get people out. Eventually, we ended whatever this standoff was.
As people were leaving and going and getting their bikes off of the Puck Building fence, the police at one point, they pull out a saw and cut a couple bikes off of the Puck Building.
This was part of the targeting and the selecting of critical mass bike ride community for this kind of punishment. And it's chilling, it's intimidating. I think it's overkill, it's unnecessary.
Have you ever been in a criminal court case before?
No, I haven't even been a juror on a criminal court case.
The whole process is very much political. The fact that I'm going to court and I don't know what's going to happen, and it's, you know, March is how many? It's 7 months or 8 months after my arrest. It's like the punishment is the process.
I didn't have any special fear of police officers or suspicion of them or paranoia or thinking that somehow they were working for the other side. You know, I thought that they were as much a victim of the system as I was. But now, I just don't feel so trusting at all.
It's really up to the broader public to know and to understand what's going on out there, and for a consensus to be developed about how these types of events should be policed.
Just crazy things are going on to stop a few people from biking. But if you could see what they did with the community gardens, they spent just as much money. So you have to wonder, is it really about the bicycling, or is it about community versus the corporate behavior?
This amount of policing has really translated into a loss of democracy for people.
It is dangerous and illegal to ride a bicycle in a procession on the public streets within New York City.
The police department has always sent, you know, a certain amount of police officers on bikes or scooters. You know, they go up along the sides and, you know, and cork and facilitate the ride as it goes. And it seems to me that, you know, that doesn't cost nearly as much money as the way they're cracking down now. And it kept everyone safe for years, so why can't it continue to keep them safe? You never kind of want to believe that much money and governmental power could be wielded, you know, because essentially somebody has a grudge. But that's really what it starts to feel like when this goes on for months and months completely unchecked.
You want to talk about a waste of tax dollars? This is a waste of tax dollars. We have to be here because of this.
So originally, I decided to take this to trial because it seemed like there was unfair, politically motivated, preemptive mass arrests. But that almost seems like nothing compared to what's going on now.
And there was a...
excerpt of the documentary Still We Ride, produced by Elizabeth Press, Andrew Lynn, and Christopher Ryan. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on 400 radio and TV stations around the country, on Pacifica Radio, NPR radio stations, low-power FM college and community stations, as well as public access TV, PBS stations, and both satellite TV networks, Dish Network, Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV. We're also on DirecTV, Channel 375, and we video and audio podcast at democracynow.org. Our guests to talk about police surveillance of protest are Eileen Clancy of Eyewitness Video, Jim Dwyer, New York Times reporter. Paul J. Brown joins us on the phone, Deputy Commissioner of Public Information for the New York Police Department. And Norman Siegel is with us in studio, longtime civil rights attorney, former head of the New York Civil Liberties Union. Jim Dwyer, let's begin with you, your expose of last Thursday. What did you find?
We found that in the last 16 months there was a very robust presence by disguised police officers at a number of events, including anti-war protests, the Poor People's March during the RNC last year, and also at these mass bike rides, these group bike rides called Critical Mass. And until September 11th, the surveillance by the police of First Amendment protected activities had been one of the most controlled and limited of all police powers, not only in New York City, but in big cities around the country. And also, there were a lot of restrictions on the FBI. And after September 11th, there were a lot of revisions made to those controls. They were done in each jurisdiction, but they all essentially moved in the same direction, which was to ease those restrictions. And New York, Mayor Bloomberg and Commissioner Kelly both sought to ease those restrictions, saying that the threat of terrorism was so great that they were handcuffed in preventing future terrorists because of these rules.
Talk about the videotape that you got.
The videotapes were from a variety of sources. They were all accumulated by Eyewitness Video, by Eileen Clancy's sort of one-person operation, but with many tentacles, I would say, of information coming in from civilians, bystanders who were filming things, legal observers, activists who were filming stuff, as well as the police department's own video, which was made public in effect during these trials of people arrested at these protests or at the bike rides, because the videotape would be turned over as part of the discovery process during the pretrial proceedings.
And these videotapes that you say document undercover police work, describe them.
Well, in some cases, they're very explicit. You see people who are dressed up with buttons like "I am a shameless agitator" or buttons describing the mayor with a kind of a vulgarity, and people putting stickers on their bikes that say "I'm bicycle riding is not a crime" and so forth. And then they would go out in either circulate in the protests, or they would ride in the bike rides. Sometimes they would be videotaping. Sometimes they would be holding slogans, protest signs or signs indicating some kind of political belief. And in one case, or in a couple of cases, what you see is what appear to be faked or sham arrests taking place of these individuals. And the purpose of those arrests is not entirely clear, but we know that in one instance it had a very profound effect on a demonstration when a man who was arrested, who seemed to be standing on a sidewalk doing nothing more than holding a sign, he was arrested by a police lieutenant, or a police lieutenant started the process of arresting him. The crowd, this is during the RNC, objected to his arrest. People started shouting, "Let him go, let him go." And then a confrontation developed between police officers in tactical riot gear and some of the people who were yelling and hollering about this arrest. When you look at the videotape closely, it shows that the man actually did not have handcuffs on when he was led away. When they unzipped his backpack, it seemed that he had a radio of some sort in there. It looked like a two-way radio. And he seemed to have a very cordial relationship, which was not typical at the moment of what was going on between the police and some of the demonstrators. So that was a pretty interesting piece of video. And there was another piece where some people were arrested during one of the bike rides, and one of the officers, well, let me not jump ahead and say he's an officer. One of the people who's arrested gets down on his knees, and he says to the arresting officer, "I'm on the job," which is police lingo for meaning I'm a cop, I'm a police officer too. And so the uniformed officer responds by saying, "Hey, Louie," typically a way of saying, "Hey, Lieutenant, hey, Louie, he's on the job, he's under." So this man was led down the block and got back on his bike, and away he rode. And two other people who were with him, a woman and a man, were put into the van with other people who were arrested. But about 25 minutes later, they're videotaped down on the Lower East Side at the scene of yet another arrest. So it was pretty clear that those people were not bike riders. It looks like the person who was arrested on 23rd Street holding the sign was not a protester. That's what the videotape show.
Paul Brown, your deputy commissioner of public information, your response to the New York Times reporter's exposé, Jim Dwyer.
Well, I think there's a fundamental misunderstanding of what it's just wrong, flatly wrong, to say that after September 11th, our activity in these areas picked up. That's not what our reform of the Hanshu Accord was all about. We went to court to have more leeway in conducting undercover investigations. Nothing described by Jim Dwyer was an undercover investigation. None of the officers were undercover officers. And it's more than a semantical difference in the police department. What he describes is activities typically done by anti-crime or plainclothes officers assigned to large crowds, whether it be New Year's Eve, whether it be a political protest, to act or direct the actions of uniformed police officers when some sort of violence or criminal activity of any kind breaks out or law-breaking. So whether that would be to arrest a bottle thrower in the middle of the crowd or direct his arrest, or to identify the people blocking crosstown traffic during one of the mass bike rides in order to have them arrested. That's what he described. That's not undercover activity. It's not undercover police officers. It's not covered by a Hanshu. We did this kind of activity before and after September 11th and is virtually unchanged. And that's the basic mistake in that reporting.
They're not undercover. They're what?
They're anti-crime or plainclothes officers. It may be a semantical difference in Jim's head, but it's not in the police department's head.
Actually, if I
Jim Dwyer.
And the other thing is, when he uses the term, "Hey, Louis, he's under," for your listeners, under means under arrest, not undercover.
Right. Well, he was promptly released, whether he was undercover, plainclothes, or whatever. But
Can I just interrupt 1 second, Jim? You're modulating in and out. I don't know if there's a way to improve what I'm hearing.
Okay, I'll try and talk louder. One of the things that happened when the police department went into the when the city went in after 9/11 and sought different kinds of guidelines about the use of undercover officers was that it asked specifically that the distinction between undercover officers and plainclothes officers be eliminated from the guidelines that were put on them, and the court granted that request. It may still be that the function is, as Commissioner Brown says, entirely different, but that not to get too semantical on anyone.
On this issue of Hanshu, people who are not familiar with this agreement, I'd like to bring in Norman Siegel, longtime civil rights attorney. Explain what the Hanshu Agreement is in New York.
Well, first, it's Barbara Hanshu and other political activists in the early 1970s went to court on the premise that they were engaged in First Amendment-protected activity and that the police were engaged in surveillance, spying on them in violation of the First Amendment. In 1985, an agreement was entered into with the City of New York and the police department that, in effect, was a traditional check and balance on the police department. So with regard to video cameras at First Amendment activity, the police could turn on the video cameras when illegal activity was taking place or, in fact, someone was threatening or that there was imminent activity that was going to lead to illegal activity. There are also provisions in there with regard to when an undercover could engage in undercover. And it was basically a check. There was a three-person commission that was set up that was supposedly independent of the police department that would review complaints by political activists with regard to surveillance, and they would put out an annual report. And as Mr. Brown has stated, after 9/11, the police department in the city of New York went into the federal court and were able to lower the standard. And one of the concerns that I and other people in the civil rights community have is that we don't think the traditional check, the accountability that we need in a democracy over our law enforcement people, is present. And with the lowering of the standard, I believe that this activity has increased and will increase in the months and years to come.
And that issue, Paul Brown, of undercover versus plain clothes that Jim Dwyer just raised.
There are two distinct functions here, what I'm talking about. And what, regardless of how you described it, that may not be important to your listeners. Police officers who go to demonstrations in plain clothes, or what we call anti-crime cops, they're there for one purpose and that only, and it has nothing to do with political surveillance. And that's the misleading part of that story. They're there to either intervene or to direct police intervention on some kind of law breaking that breaks out at that particular event.
Why do they get arrested?
They may get arrested or appear to be arrested just to keep functioning. I'm not certain that they did get arrested. I don't know who these individuals are, but assuming if some of them are police officers, they may be led away as if they're under arrest, and then they continue to function.
We have to break. When we come back, we'll continue this conversation with Paul Brown, Deputy Commissioner of New York Police Department, Deputy Commissioner of Public Information Norman Siegel, longtime civil rights attorney Jim Dwyer of the New York Times, and we'll bring in Eileen Clancy of Eyewitness Video, who has videotape of so much of this undercover work. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're talking about police surveillance of political activity here in New York City. Our guests are Norman Siegel, longtime civil rights attorney, former head of the New York Civil Liberties Union, Jim Dwyer of the New York Times, did an expose on Thursday about police surveillance of protest over the last year. Paul Brown joins us on the phone. He is the Deputy Commissioner of Public Information for the New York Police Department, and Eileen Clancy is with us of Eyewitness Video. Explain what you have documented in the videotapes that you have gathered, Eileen.
Well, the videotapes that are contained in the New York Times story show not merely the presence of police officers who are attending these events, because, of course, there are actually, at some of these protests and demonstrations, there are dozens and even hundreds of police officers involved in policing these essentially always nonviolent, peaceful demonstrations. The videotapes, these videotapes are looking at police officers who are going an extra step, dressing in clothing to appear to be demonstrators, putting on political slogans and stickers, in large parts in participating in the events, in the case of the bicycle rides, bicycle riding with the bike riders, that type of thing, and maybe that have gone over the line line, I think, in certain ways. The situation with the woman that's featured in the Time story, who appears to be an undercover police officer, it's not merely that she was participating in the events. She seemed to be calling in to police commanders where the locations of things, that type of thing. And then apparently she was arrested and then released very quickly. It appeared at some other events. But she also participated in a very tiny event, about 15 or 20 bicycle riders who were having a memorial vigil, a silent memorial vigil, for a 21-year-old woman that was run over by a garbage truck on Houston Street in Avenue A. And in remembrance of this woman, a few bicycle riders got together, joined together at Union Square, and they were followed by I don't know how many police officers in unmarked vehicles, motorcycles, vans, and we don't know what else. And this woman police officer participated in this small event. It is hard to imagine. I mean, these bicycle riders rode single file in bicycle lanes, obeyed all the traffic laws. And as I said, they were followed by a large amount of police, considering their numbers, many more police than were in this attended this little ride. Then they stopped at the scene where the woman had been killed. They had a memorial event, passed out flowers and so forth. And this police officer videotaped the individuals involved in this event. This is absolutely repugnant. I mean, I think what we have to do is we have to think about what is it the police are doing? Is there a legitimate purpose to this? What is it supposed to accomplish beyond intimidation?
Paul Brown of the New York Police Department, your response.
Well, I think starting to say that these events are always nonviolent is just not the case. Beginning in 2002, when I returned a second time to the police department, New York had to cope with hosting the World Economic Forum. During that event, you had self-described anarchists who would mask up, carry bottles of urine to throw at the police, and bricks in their knapsacks, in one instance in an attempt to smash windows at the Plaza Hotel. We had anti-crime cops close to them, and when they attempted to move out, they were arrested. During the RNC, there were others who wanted to stop delegate buses from not only just peaceful protests, but others who wanted to, after the main march, wanted to affect a shutdown of the convention. It was an attempt to shut down Wall Street. Grandiose, I granted, but an attempted nonetheless. Attempt to stop delegate buses from reaching the convention site. In those instances, anti-crime officers, plainclothes officers, were involved in identifying where those individuals were so that uniformed officers could move in.
Rationale, what's the rationale for critical mass for violence? It's been going on for 10 years. Let me finish my question. For 10 years, it's going on.
Well, you ask me what's the rationale, I'll tell you. Critical mass was going along well until a few months before the convention when the ride was essentially hijacked by people who wanted to make more, who wanted to shut down the city in the process. You took over the FDR Drive, the West Side Highway. That's when the police began devoting resources to it. And you just can't decide that you, because you want to make a point about bike riding, that you can shut down cross town traffic.
In the last year, has there been that kind of activity?
Yes, there has, and we've made the arrest to stop it.
I want to go back to Still We Ride, the documentary about the critical mass movement. This is just a two-minute clip, and it begins with attorney Steve Hyman talking about what it takes for people not to be arrested. And it goes on to bring you the voices of police officers who are on the scene. This is Still We Ride, the documentary that was produced by Democracy Now! Producer Elizabeth Press, along with Andrew Lynn and Christopher Ryan.
Real issues as to whether or not a permit is really just a device by the police to try to put an end to critical mass. And because once you have that device, that permit, they then set the ground rules and the terms and when, where, how far it goes. So once that starts, then critical mass, as it is conceived and as it participants participate in it will be at an end.
If you have a right to do something, you should not have to ask the government for permission to do that.
It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that these guys sit around and figure, hey, we got to stop this. They had to stop the ban shell from being a place of free speech back some years ago, so they demolished it. They had to stop spontaneous marches from taking place, so they put permits on everything and put fee. You have to pay a fee to get a permit and this, that, and the other thing. They are trying through every means to limit our ability to dissent.
If these guys, you know, apply for the route and stuff like that, they can do whatever. But they don't want to go that route. That's the thing.
But the peaceable people probably don't come anymore. What's going on? Used to come with bicycles, with the seats on, with their kids.
Right.
You don't want to bring your kids to the circus. You know, this is ridiculous. They've been riding for 10 years. Never a problem. Never a problem. You know, it's always been. But right at the RNC, they decided to use it as a tool to protest other people, not the critical mass people. Critical mass people have been riding for a long time. Never a problem. Very peaceably, obey the rules, do what they got to do. And then they were infiltrated by the ACLU and other groups and. And they turned it into, now it's become a political protest.
Do you think it can ever go back? Like, how could they go backwards and get the police off their back?
And now it's become this. It's become an anarchist group. So.
I heard that they were still arresting people even if they stopped at the lights and stuff.
No, they can't. What are they going to arrest them? What are they going to charge them with? What would they
the parade thing.
You have to break law in order for a police officer to arrest them. That's just the way it is.
That is an excerpt of Still We Ride. And those are the voices of police officers on the street. One saying, what are they going to charge them with? Another saying it was a peaceful group until it was infiltrated by the ACLU. And now it's become an anarchist group. Norman Siegel, your response.
Well, first of all, infiltrated by the ACLU, just not even close to reality. I think it shows that the police themselves, rank and file, I'm not sure that this is a very effective tactic. And also with regard to the legitimate government interest of making sure that there isn't violence at any of the events, I think when the police department has substantial evidence, reasonable basis for having people at a First Amendment activity, I've always felt that officers in uniform, which they do have, is the best deterrent to any kind of violent activity. And the idea of putting people in non-uniform, plain clothes, as well as undercover, undermines what a democracy is supposed to be about. If I go to a First Amendment peaceful protest activity, the government should not have a file or a video database of my peaceful activity. And the part that also troubles me is that when they're doing the video surveillance, what's happening to that video? If, in fact, the video shows illegal activity, then you can keep it for the criminal case, Mr. Brown. But when, in fact, the video shows no illegal activity, are you erasing that material? Are you making sure that in a democracy we don't have the government having video databases on peaceful First Amendment activity?
Paul Brown of the New York Police Department.
We don't keep political databases. We do preserve video for trials and for arrest situations, and as you well know, because some of them have been turned over. For discovery purposes.
Let me just bring in Eileen Clancy for a minute.
Okay.
Of eyewitness video.
One quick point about the bike rides. We've also asked repeatedly to work out an arrangement with the organizers. Although they claim there's no organization, there is organization of the rides. We've asked to work with them to so they could go forward and have cross down traffic accommodated, some safety issues that we're worried about accommodated, and the police department's been refused on that.
Eileen Clancy.
Well, ever since the Tompkins Square Park riots, I've made it clear years ago that it was critically important for police officers to be identified in case there were problems with misconduct so they could be followed up on. There had been for years and years a sense that pretty much you had police officers with numbers on their riot helmets and that sort of thing in New York. And having so many police officers at these scenes now, you're not sure if they're police officers. Sometimes they actually give commands to people or push people or move them around. People don't know how to react because you're not there. They don't know that they're police officers. It creates this kind of confusion. And it's it's really impossible in cases of misconduct to track down, to investigate these properly. CCRB has complained about this.
The Civilian Complaint Review Board.
Thank you, folks. But also, one of the important things, it's not clear at all why police officers who are videotaping these political demonstrations are not identified. Under the original Hanshu rules, they all had to be identified as police officers. And now pretty much every time you see them, they do not have any police identification on them at all. And they are sometimes doing this clandestinely from inside cars and vehicles. It's a very confusing situation.
Commissioner Brown.
Well, they are identified. They were the officers who do videotaping are in... are either in uniform or wearing jackets.
That's absolutely not true, Commissioner Brown. I'm sorry. That's just absolutely not true. It's plainly visible. I mean, what comes to mind right away is a police officer wearing a black leather jacket and a Che Guevara T-shirt that's seen at many of these critical mass events without any police identification whatsoever.
Well, I can.
This is typical.
They wear wind jackets that say Taru on the back of a technical.
Some do. I think it's quite clear some do, some don't. And we've been showing videotape of people who are whatever you call undercover or plain clothes.
Well, I don't know. You're saying they're undercover. I explained. I know it may not be an important difference to you, but it's a very important
difference. Well, I said undercover or plain clothes.
Undercover officers conduct investigations of groups. That's why Hanshu is so important.
Let me just ask you.
Anti-crime cops do not.
Before we get to the end of the program, I wanted to ask you about the relationship between the New York Police Department, FBI, and CIA. In January 2002, David Cohen was appointed to be the NYPD's first Deputy Commissioner of Intelligence. He came to New York after a 35-year career with the CIA. From 95 to 97, Cohen served as the CIA's Directorate of Operations, where he oversaw the agency's worldwide operations, managed the CIA's global network of offices and personnel, and maintained agency relationships with foreign intelligence and security services. At the time of his appointment, Police Commissioner Raymond Kelly said of David Cohen, quote, David has a strong reputation for forging ties and working effectively with other government agencies, foreign governments, and the private sector, and is drawing upon those strengths and contacts will greatly benefit the city as he directs the police department's intelligence efforts. Your response, Commissioner Brown.
Well, what's the question?
The relationship between the New York Police Department and the CIA, where David Cohen comes from and now heads intelligence for New York Police Department.
Okay. Well, it's an excellent relationship, one that I don't think we had some relationship, but not to the extent now, where I think part of the reason we're so successful in placing officers overseas in key capitals and inside some of their counterterrorism organizations is a result of the relationships that Commissioner Cohen has forged and had already established from his experience in the CIA. But we now have people in Tel Aviv, Amman, Jordan, the UK, Interpol, and Toronto, and Montreal, focusing on their counterterrorism activities and asking the New York question. Essentially, have you seen anything you're seeing, say, in Amman, Jordan, connected to New York in terms of terrorism? And to be able to do that and do it relatively quickly, I think, is one example.
Norman Siegel, your response to CIA-police relationship?
I think that what New York is doing, and we're finding out because of Jim and Eileen's work, is very similar to what's going on the national level. And I think New Yorkers and Americans have to be asking the question, how much power do we want to give to our law enforcement people post 9/11, taking into account that with regard to spying and First Amendment activity? Recently on East 79th Street, a group of seniors were involved in a housing demonstration, and Taru showed up and started videoing these people, the police, and it was across the street from Mayor Bloomberg's house. There was no illegal activity. There was an agreement with the police department. This is the beginning of very serious, substantial questions about how much power we want to give to the NYPD with regard to First Amendment activity.
We have to leave it there. Norman Siegel, civil rights attorney, Paul Brown, Deputy Commissioner of New York Police Department, Jim Dwyer of the New York Times, and Eileen Clancy of Eyewitness Video. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Berkshire, Fabdo Kadush, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Maddie Harper, Nell Geiser, Aaron Mate, Mike DeFilippo as our engineer. Special thanks to Elizabeth Press. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.